Welcome, everybody. It sure is good to see you all tonight, and I just want to begin by thanking you for being here. So many of you have been here every time this week, and many of you have been here every time you've been able to, and you've wanted to be here the other times that you haven't been able to, and that's just such an encouragement to me. I know I've said that before, but I just can't say it enough, and what I often feel about weeks like this is that at the end of the week when I pack up and go home, you all have given me far more than anything that I could leave with you. So I just want you to know how much this means to me and how encouraging you all are, not just to me personally, but because of the things you're doing for the Lord and the things that He's done in your lives. So thanks for being here tonight. As Mark mentioned, we're going to talk about failure tonight. And I want to just begin by asking you to think about this. When we talk about failure, The question or the issue is not really an issue of if we fail. It's an issue of when. Because everybody who's ever been a servant of the Lord, if you've been a Christian, then you've failed. And even if you're not a Christian, you understand that failure is a part of what we deal with in life. Everybody fails. And anybody who's ever had a heart to serve God is going to come to a point in your life where you're going to fail in some way. You're going to be rejected in some way. And the issue is not really about the failure. The issue is how we respond to those failures. What are we going to do when we mess up? Or what are we going to do when we're rejected by the people around us? When we're kept in some way from doing the things for God that we really want to do? Just think of it in this way. I mean, think about the example or the difference between Peter on one hand and Judas on the other. Why do we remember those two in such different ways? It's not really because one failed and the other didn't. Both of them failed in catastrophic ways. And denying Jesus wasn't any better than betraying Jesus. But I want to suggest to you that the primary difference between those two individuals, the reason we remember them in such different ways, is because of how they responded to those failures. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to take the life of Moses, and through his example, we're just going to look at this concept of, we're going to look at what we can learn about how we deal with failure. Because as Mark also mentioned, you might think that Moses' life was one that didn't experience, Moses was a person that didn't experience a lot of failure, and yet, as we go through his story tonight, you're going to find that his life was full of failure. Now, as we think about Moses' story, one of the things that we're going to do is periodically we're going to stop and I'm going to ask you to try to make some connections between Moses' life and your life. And there will be a number of them to see. But what I want you to see is that Moses' story is not really that much different from your story and from my story. And so the things that God taught him about how to deal with failure and rejection are some of the very same lessons that will help us when we fail and when we're rejected to take our place back in God's work and to not let those failures and those rejections cause us to fall down without getting back up. Open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 3. And we're going to just read the first 10 verses in Exodus 3 to set the scene. And then we're going to talk about Moses' life leading up to this, and we'll come back to Exodus 3. But it's a little bit of a longer reading. I do want you to open your Bibles, though, and read along with me, because I think this will be very important to see. Exodus chapter 3, and we'll look at the first 10 verses. And I want you to just get a picture of where Moses is in his life when we get to Exodus 3. Exodus 3, we'll begin reading in verse 1. It says, "Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, 'I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up.' When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, 'Moses, Moses.' And he said, 'Here I am.' Then he said, 'Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said also, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Amorite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. What I want you to think about is, when we see this text, or when we meet Moses here in Exodus 3, where is he and what is he doing? The very first verse tells us that he's in Midian, pasturing the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro. And what I want you to think about is, how did Moses get here? I mean, because if you know Moses' story, you know that Moses wasn't from Midian. Moses from Egypt. And by the time we get to Exodus 3, he's about 80 years old, but he spent a good portion of his life growing up in the house of Pharaoh, one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, rulers on the planet at that time. How does somebody who has royal connections and royal upbringing go from that to herding sheep in the middle of a desert? Well, let's consider that and try to answer that question. You know that Moses' story begins at a time where the Israelites were oppressed and made slaves by the Egyptians. And they were growing so numerous, the Israelites were, that Pharaoh was worried they were going to take over the nation. And so he issues a decree that all of the male Hebrew babies were to be thrown into the Nile River and killed. And yet we know that many of the Israelites, because of their faith in God, refused that order. And Moses' parents, Amram and Jochebed, saw that he was a beautiful child and refused to follow Pharaoh's instruction. And so you remember what they had to do? They had to hide him in a basket in the Nile River. But they could only do that for so long before he was found out. He was discovered. You remember who found him in the river? It was Pharaoh's daughter. And so she finds this Hebrew baby and she has compassion. She has sympathy on him. And so she takes him and she draws him out of the water. And she takes him to be one of her own. Now, she has she wants him to be nursed by a Hebrew. And so she meets with Moses' sister, as it turns out, and Moses' sister takes him to his mother and has her nurse him for a period of time. But that's where he gets his name from. The name Moses sounds like the Hebrew word meaning drawn out. And what's interesting about Moses' life is that it wasn't just a name that was given to him because of his experience kind of in his infancy. But it's really a perfect name for the rest of his life, because Moses' life was a series of experiences where he's being drawn from one place to another. Of course, when he's a baby, he's drawn out from the Nile River by Pharaoh's daughter. But then not long after that, he's drawn out from a Hebrew family into Pharaoh's family. And he spends 40 years growing up in Pharaoh's family as an Egyptian. But we know that when he turns 40, he's drawn out again. This time from Pharaoh's family back to his Hebrew roots. Now, we'll talk a little bit later on about what happens at that critical juncture, but you may remember that once he goes back to his Hebrew roots, his intention is he feels like he's going to deliver his people. But some things happen to change his mind, and he has to suddenly flee Egypt, and he's drawn out once again. He's drawn out at age 40 from Egypt to go into Midian. And then later on in his life, he's going to be drawn out again from Midian back to Egypt. And so this name Moses is really just sort of a picture of what's going to be his entire life story. What's great about it is that it's not just really a picture of what God was doing in Moses' life, though. It's really a picture of what God was going to do with the entire nation of Israel, what God was going to do with Moses' people. just like Moses had been drawn out from Egypt, God was going to do the very same thing with this Israelite nation. He was going to draw them out of Egypt to a land that was that he had prepared just for them. Now, here's the first point of connection I want you to think about and to make with your life. If you're a Christian, can you think about any ways that maybe this theme in Moses' life is sort of a theme in your life? Like, if you're a Christian, in many ways, in some ways, you are a Moses. You're somebody who's been drawn out of one place, one life, into another life. God's drawn you out of the world or out of the life that you were a part of and the choices you were making, and He's brought you into this new place, this new purpose, this new identity. I love the picture of Him drawing us because it's one of the ways that Scripture talks about how God would work through the Messiah. Remember Jesus saying in John 12 that if I'm lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men to myself. The history of the world is a history of a God who is constantly drawing people out of sin and darkness into His marvelous light. And so if you're a Christian, if you're somebody who's serious about following the Lord tonight, then you are a Moses. You're somebody who's been drawn out. Now, let's go on from there, and I want you to think about why it was that Moses would leave the things that he left in Egypt. Because if you were to show Moses' story to somebody in the world, it doesn't make any sense. Why give up what you have in Egypt, in the house of Pharaoh, to go and be counted among a group of slaves, and then to get run out of the country and have to go spend the next 40 years of your life herding sheep? Why do that? I'm going to share with you three ways to answer that question. But before we do that, I want to show you what the Hebrew writer says about Moses' reasons for leaving Egypt. Remember in Hebrews chapter 11, the Hebrew writer gives us an explanation for why Moses left the wealth of Egypt. Let's read verses 24 through 27. Hebrews 11, verses 24 through 27. The writer says, "By faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen." So you'll notice there that the Hebrew writer says that he considered the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Just think about that for a moment. What was it that he was giving up? What were the treasures of Egypt? Any of you ever been to like these traveling exhibits that come to science museums about the kind of the wealth of ancient Egypt or the discovery of King Tut's tomb? You know what it means when the Hebrew writer talks about the treasures of Egypt. Egypt, there's a reason that of all the ancient cultures, Egyptian culture is one of the ones that we're fascinated with. Because they were loaded. I mean, they were one of the wealthiest cultures that was on the planet at that time. You go back and you look at the things that have been discovered from the pyramids and from their tombs, and it's gold upon gold. They had so much gold, they'd mummify their cats and their pets. And anything that they could take with them to kind of preserve into the afterlife, they'd cover it in gold and they'd put it in the tomb. You know, Moses could have had all that. And some people even suggest that as part of Pharaoh's family, Moses was perhaps not even just in line to be kind of a royal official, but some people even suggest he was in line for the throne. Moses could have been a Pharaoh one day. He could have been the mummy that we're looking at in, you know, the science museums instead of King Tut. Maybe it's King Moses. But Moses understood what the Hebrew writer says about him. That for all of those pleasures that Egypt could offer, the problem was they were just passing. Passing pleasures, that's the phrase. They weren't going to last. They were going to be there and they might be great, but they weren't going to last forever. And so Moses was willing to trade that in. Moses understood three things, I think, that motivated him to give up the wealth of Egypt. The first thing was that life in Pharaoh's family was really just a dead-end road. That for all the pleasure he could find there, it wasn't going to last forever. And only God was the one who could give him the sort of immortality that the Egyptians really were after. Moses also understood something about himself. He understood who he really was. I mean, even though he had spent 40 years growing up in Egypt, and we're going to see that he learned the literature and the language of the Egyptians, he understood that at the end of the day, he wasn't an Egyptian. He was a Hebrew. He was one of God's people. And so he was willing to leave behind this identity that wasn't really his identity to reclaim who he really was. And then finally, Moses understood that he had been delivered as a baby so that he could deliver others. And so rather than staying in comfort in Pharaoh's household while all of his countrymen perished from being abused and being enslaved, Moses understood that he had people that he could deliver. Now here's the second point of connection that I want you to think about. Moses' reasons for giving up the wealth of Egypt are some of the same reasons that you and I give up the world to become Christians. I mean, you think about all the things that the world, perhaps at different times in your life, maybe before you were a Christian, the things that you thought about having, and they were pleasurable, to be sure. But at some point, if you made the decision, if you made the choice to give that up for Christ, part of the reason is probably because you started to look ahead and think ahead and realize, you know, all the things that the world can give me, they're incredible, but they're just passing. Like, they're just not going to be there forever. And all of that pleasure is just a dead-end road. So you gave it up. Maybe you also gave it up because you understood who you really were. You, no matter what the world said about your identity and where you find that, you understood that your identity comes from the fact that you are created in God's image, that you're made to reflect His glory, that that's who you are fundamentally. And then you also understood perhaps at some point in your life that God had done things in your life to deliver you, but that you were surrounded by people who were still in need of that same deliverance. And so somehow it was impressed on you that God could use you to be that same deliverer for other people. And so Moses' reasons for giving up Egypt are the same reasons that so many of us give up the world to pursue God. Now, let's hold your spot in Exodus 3 and turn with me over to Acts chapter 7. Because this is really, in many ways, the pivotal point in Moses' life. Acts chapter 7 gives the account of a Christian named Stephen. And Stephen is giving basically a history lesson to the Jewish leaders, kind of showing them that their history was one of rejection of God's people and rebellion against God. But he uses Moses as an example. And I want you to notice what Stephen points out about Moses in Acts 7. We'll begin reading in verse 20. Acts 7, verse 20. So Moses, here's the picture of Moses. Here's where he is in his life. He's given up all those things in Egypt. He's ready to deliver others because God's delivered him. And we're going to find out what's going to happen. Moses is about 40 years old. Verse 20, it was at this time that Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of God, and he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. And after he had been set outside, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. I want you to file that verse away in your minds, and we'll come back to it. He was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. Verse 23, but when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. On the following day, he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, men, you are brethren, why do you injure one another? But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you? At this remark, Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. So what changed the trajectory of Moses' life? One word, failure. rejection. And here was this man who had given up everything that he had ever known for 40 years to try to deliver his people, but his people didn't want to be delivered by him. And so here Moses is, being rejected, trying to figure out how to handle that, and it shook him so much that he left Egypt. And it wasn't just that his people rejected them, it was that he realized that they weren't the only ones who knew that he had murdered the Egyptian. He realized that word had gotten out, that the Egyptians knew what he had done. And so there was no place for him anymore in that land. Now, have you ever known a Christian that this happened to? Maybe, like, not a Christian that murdered somebody, but a Christian that tried to help other Christians? Or a Christian that tried to share their faith, or for whatever reason, do something to make a difference for the Lord? Somebody who was stirred up to get involved in God's work and use their abilities for His glory. And something happened. Somebody rejected him. Somebody said, I don't really think you're doing a good job. You don't really have the skills to do this. Or whatever the thing was, it shook him up and it just kind of leveled him. Maybe that's your story. I mean, maybe you're that Christian. And here's what I want you to think about tonight. What defined Moses was what he was going to do with that rejection. And what defines each of us is where we go from there. How are we going to handle, or how are we going to respond to rejection once we're initially turned away? It caused Moses to run, to give up, to pursue a different course of action for 40 years. And I've known Christians that had that happen to them, and for the next 40 years, that's all they could really think about. And some never really even got back to the point of wanting to get involved again in the Lord's work. If that's you tonight, or if you know somebody like that, what I hope you'll do is take courage from what God does in Moses' life to help him get over, to help him move past this rejection. You know, the reality for Moses was that this wasn't the only obstacle that he was going to face in his life, not the only barrier that he was going to deal with. There were times in Moses' life where he dealt with self-doubt, where he felt like he wasn't the right person for the job. We're actually going to see that here back in Exodus 3 in a moment. There were times where he dealt with complaining. No sooner had he come back at age 80 and led the Israelites out of the wilderness, or out of Egypt into the wilderness, than they turn around and they start talking about how much better it was in Egypt. And you just led us out here to die. For 40 years, constant complaining was an obstacle that he faced. He dealt with burnout. There were times where he was so tired, he asked God to just take his life on the spot. Just kill me dead. There were times where he dealt with idolatry. The people, as he's up on Mount Sinai getting the law from God, the people making this golden calf and bowing down and worshiping to it. He dealt with his own sin. He dealt with defeat, military defeat. He dealt with prejudice. You remember the story of how Miriam and Aaron, his own siblings, looked down on Moses because of the woman that he married? Moses dealt with that. He dealt with complacence from the people. He dealt with pride. He dealt with people who questioned his authority. All of these were obstacles that he dealt with. Now, think about that list. Sin, burnout, self-doubt, idolatry. I'll tell you, what's helpful about Moses' struggles is that those are my struggles. And I would guess that if we were to talk long enough about this, we'd realize that these are his struggles, or all of our struggles. So let's look at what God does to help Moses through this. Now, when we go back to chapter 3, what we're going to find here, back in picking up in verse 11, is that God has called him to go back into Egypt to deliver his people. And what Moses is going to do is he's going to lodge a series of protests. Reasons that he's going to give to God that he can't really do this. And so what I want you to notice is each of Moses' protests and what God does to answer that. The first protest is in verse 11. But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" So Moses' first response to God, or his first protest to God, is, "I'm not the right one for the job." Sort of paraphrase that. But who am I to be the one to go and deliver your people from this mighty Pharaoh? You ever felt like that? who am I to do the Lord's work? I mean, somebody like me who's had such a mess and had such a hard time getting over the sins in my life and dealing with discouragement in my life, I know where I've been. I know the choices that I've made. I know the skeletons in my closet. Who am I for God to work through me? Notice how God answers that protest. Verse 12. And he said, "Certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain." So Moses says to God, "Who am I? I'm not the right man for the job." And God's answer to him essentially is, "Well, I am." You know, that's kind of how God talked in Exodus. His answer to Moses is, "I'm going to be with you, and it's not really about you, Moses. Because I'm going to be with you, that's all you really need." So that's first protest. Second protest comes right on the heels of this in verse 13. Moses has a long way to go. He's not close to being convinced yet. Notice verse 13. "Then Moses said to God, 'Behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?'" So the second thing that he says is, suppose that I go to the Israelite people and I say, "Hey, God sent me to deliver you." And they ask me, "Well, how are we going to know that? Like, what's his name? What am I going to say?" You know, another way to kind of paraphrase that protest is, Moses is basically saying, "I don't know what to say. I don't know enough." You ever hear Christians talk like that? Or you ever thought like that as a Christian? You know, "I just don't feel like I know enough to be useful for the Lord." Look at God's answer to that. Verse 14. God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" God furthermore said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt.'" So you notice that when Moses protests and says, "Well, what am I going to say? I don't know enough." You notice what God does? God basically teaches him. He tells him, "This is what you're going to say if you show up and they won't listen to you. You tell them this." God's answer to Moses' protest that he doesn't know enough is basically, "Well, then I'll teach you what you need to know. If you don't know what to say, I'll teach you what you need to say." Moses still isn't convinced, though. Skip down to chapter 4 and let's notice the third protest that Moses lodges. Verse 1. Chapter 4, verse 1. "Then Moses said, 'What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you.'" So his third protest is essentially, "What if others don't listen? What if I get there and I tell them what your name is and they say, 'Well, God didn't really send you. So what do I do then?'" I mean, you can tell for Moses that'd be a big deal. He's already been shaken by rejection. By the way, it's fascinating to think about that, how that happens in the lives of Christians today. For so many Christians, the rejection that really shakes us is not the rejection we get from the world. Sometimes it's the rejection we get from our own brothers and sisters. And that was the thing that seemed to shake Moses up the most. But look at how God responds to that in verse 2. "The Lord said to him, 'What is that in your hand?' And he said, 'A staff.' Then he said, 'Throw it on the ground.' So he threw it on the ground and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail.' So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. 'That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you.'" So basically Moses says, "Well, what if others don't listen?" And God gives him a sign. "Throw down your staff, it'll turn into a serpent. Grab it by the tail, it'll turn back into a staff." But Moses says, "Well, then what if they don't believe that?" God says, "If they don't believe that, take your hand and put it in your bosom and pull it out." And when Moses pulls his hand out, you remember what happens? It's covered in leprosy. And God says, put it back in your bosom and pull it out. And it's completely restored. God says, "If they don't believe that, then you go down to the Nile River and you take a cup full of water and you pour it out on the ground and watch it, it'll turn into blood." So God gives him three signs to take to the Israelites. But here's, I think, the point that I want you to consider with this. When Moses is concerned about being rejected, what God tells Moses is, be persistent. Don't just give up because they reject you once. Like, I'm going to give you sign after sign to convince them, but your job, Moses, is to just keep at it. To not be discouraged just because they may turn you away the first time. But to keep trying, to keep being persistent. Well, Moses is running out of excuses, but he's not done yet. Skip down to verse 10 and notice his fourth protest. Then Moses said to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since you have spoken to your servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." So his fourth protest is essentially, I'm not talented enough. I don't know what to say. I've never been a good spokesman. This is, of all of his protests, this is the one that is most fascinating to me. And we'll come back and talk about this a little bit more at the end of our study tonight. But for now, I want you to notice God's response to that in verse 11. The Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Or who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now then go, and I, even I, will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to say." So if Moses' protest is, "I'm not talented enough," God essentially tells him, "Moses, who made you? I mean, who put the tongue in your mouth? And so who are you to tell me that you're not smooth of speech, or you can't, your tongue doesn't work the way that it's going to need to work? I made you, Moses. And I wouldn't tell you to do something if I didn't have the confidence that you could do what I'm asking you to do." Moses is out of excuses. But he finally says to the Lord in verse 13, but he said, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will." He can't think of anything else to say to God. He just says, "Just send somebody else." He finally comes out and says, "I don't want to do this." And then God responds to that too. Verse 14, then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses, and he said, "Is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know that he speaks fluently, and moreover, behold, he is coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You are to speak to him and put the words in his mouth. And I, even I, will be with your mouth and his mouth. And I will teach you what you are to do." So Moses says, "God, send somebody else." And God basically tells Moses, "Well, I am. He's on his way here. But you're still going to do this. You're not off the hook." What he tells Moses is that, "I'll give you help. I understand that you're scared. I understand you feel inadequate, but I'm going to give you the help that you need. Aaron will speak for you, but you're still going to go to Egypt." Now, look at Moses' protest. "I'm not right for the job. I don't know enough. What if people don't listen to me? What if I'm rejected? I'm not talented enough. Somebody else can do it." You see the connection, Christian? How many times have you heard somebody say something like that? Or how many times has that been the thing that you told God? "I know that you want me to be a light, but I feel like such a fool." I mean, maybe your excuse is, "I'm not right for the job. There's so many other people that are better at this than me." And you know what God says to that? "It's not about you. I'll be with you." Maybe our excuse is, "Well, I don't know enough. I mean, I don't know Genesis from Revelation. And when it comes to talking about doctrine or theology, I can't do that. I don't understand things on a deep level." And God says, "Well, then I'll teach you." If our excuse is, "Well, what if others don't listen?" What God tells us is, "You be persistent. You don't give up. You keep trying to talk to people. And if they won't listen to you, I'll send other people that you can talk to." And if we tell God, "You know, I'm just not talented enough. There's so many other people that can do things so much better than I can, but I just don't have the gifts that they do." God looks at us and he says, "Who made you? Who's in a position to tell, to say what you can and can't do?" And if we say, "Well, somebody else can do it," God says, "Yeah, somebody else can, and they will, but I still want you to do my work." You start to see what's going on in Moses' life here. Everything that he comes up with to try to answer God, God's got a response for it. Now, I want to just close tonight by looking at three lessons that really kind of help us tie into Moses' life and help us understand how to deal with rejection and failure. The first thing that I think we see from this conversation between God and Moses is that every reason we can come up with for not doing God's work is just an excuse to God. And there's no excuse that's going to be good enough for Him. You know, I think every Christian who's ever taken their place in God's work and been effective for Him has had a moment like that. Like a burning bush moment. Where you realize that every reason you could come up with just wasn't going to cut it. And that God was greater than those reasons and He had answers for every one of them. And you remember for Moses how that burning bush moment started? It started with him seeing God for who He really was. And that in turn helped Moses see himself for who he really was. And that's where it starts for us. Who is God to you? Who is God in the universe? And what does that mean for your life? And maybe it's not going to be a moment in time. Maybe it's a series of moments. But it's this process that we all have to go through if we're going to be useful to God, where we realize that God's got an answer for every objection we can come up with. Now, the second thing that we'll notice ties back into Moses' fourth excuse. So I told you we're going to go back and look at that. Remember his fourth excuse he said to God back in chapter 4, verse 10. I've never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past. Was that true? I mean, you remember what we read about Moses in Stephen's speech in Acts 7? Stephen said that Moses was trained in all of the literature and learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man powerful in words and deeds. How could Moses say this? I mean, was he just in denial? You know, by the way, that's a good preacher joke. Moses has to be taken out of denial when he's a baby, and then he has to be taken out of denial when he's 80 years old. Was he just in denial, though? Like, was he just kind of making stuff up, and he had convinced himself he wasn't any good? Maybe that's it. But I think there's probably more to it than that. And here's what I think often happens in Moses' life and in our lives. God gifts us in certain ways, but over time, rejection can lead us to doubt. And when we start to doubt, we give up on using those abilities that God's given us. And when we give up on using them, that leads to inaction. And inaction leads to atrophy. And so things we used to be able to do well for the Lord, we get discouraged and we stop doing them, and we're not as good at them anymore. But here's the truth for Moses, and here's the truth for you. We are no less gifted by God after being rejected than we were before. That's what God wanted Moses to understand. That if he was powerful in words and deeds before, he could be just as powerful by the power of God in words and deeds now. And it's the same thing for you and me. Rejection doesn't rob us of the gifts that God gives us in our lives. But if we stop using them, what will often happen is we begin to atrophy. Now, third thing I want to talk about with this is once we kind of work through or start to work through those things, what does God do and how does he get us back to work? It's fascinating that in Moses' life, after this conversation, God doesn't take Moses into the wilderness for like an Egyptian boot camp. He doesn't send him to seminary for a year or two so he can get trained in how to, you know, represent God or that sort of thing. What does he do with Moses? He sends him right back into Egypt. And so much of discipleship is that very thing. It's on-the-job training. Taking our place in God's work is often going to happen that way. It's that we start to do things, we start to learn to do things by just doing them. And the only way to grow is to be willing to get outside of our comfort zones. You want to learn to lead songs? Teach a Bible class? Share the gospel with your neighbor? Learn to make a difference and to serve somebody who's dealing with a terminal illness or to talk to somebody who's lost a spouse? You want to learn to do things like that, but you feel like you can't? What's the best way to do that? How does God train us to do that? So much of the time, it's by just being willing to get outside of our comfort zones and to work at those things. I never thought growing up as a kid that I was going to be preaching. It just never crossed my mind. And I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you, to this day, I don't know that there's anything comfortable about it. I don't feel like I'm very good at it. Every time I get up to preach, I'm nervous. But at some point, what was impressed on me is that God had put people in my life. And God had done things in my life to get me to a point where I could do this. And for me to say no to that was to reject God. And to turn my back on the gifts and the people that He put in my life to encourage me. You know, God's done the same thing for you. He's given you gifts, whether you realize it or not. He's put people in your life who can help you learn to do the things that you want to do. You want to lead a song, you want to teach a class, you want to teach your neighbor, you want to learn to connect with people who are suffering. What I'll ask you to do is look around. One of the things that I love about this church, and that's impressed me in the short time that I've been here, is you all have so many gifted people here. God has given you so many things. And so if you're in a place where you want to learn to do something, but you're just not sure how to start, find somebody in this congregation who does it well. And have the courage to go up to them and say, how do you do what you do? I want to learn to do this. I just don't feel like I'm very good at it, though. Can you just help me? Like, can I watch you? Can I go with you? Can you share with me the things that have helped you get to the point where you are? And as we do that, what happens over time is that the uncomfortable becomes comfortable. And the unfamiliar becomes familiar. And so that's my encouragement to you, is to take your place in God's work. And instead of thinking of all the reasons that you can't do the things that He asked you to do, understand that He's given you everything in your life to be able to do it. I'm going to offer an invitation now. And I want to speak to a few different groups of people with this invitation. If you're a Christian, and you're somebody who's given your life to working for the Lord, you've already kind of dedicated yourself to trying to be the person that God wants you to be, the invitation to you is to not grow weary of that. Don't get tired of doing good, but keep at it. Remember who you are. Remember the things God's done in your life, and let that motivate you to press on, but to not get discouraged when things don't go the way that you want them to. If you're somebody who's, maybe you are a Christian, but you've been discouraged. Maybe you've been rejected and it just sort of laid you flat on your back and you've been trying to figure out and wrestle with how to get over that. The invitation to you is that God's got a place for you in His work. That people can benefit from your gifts, but only if you let God work through you. And so, take courage from what God does with Moses' life. And trust that He can do that with your life. And if you're not a Christian, if you're not a child of God, the invitation to you and the question to you is, what are your reasons? Why not? And this isn't easy to say and it's not easy to hear, I understand that, but here's what I'll tell you. Whatever reasons you can come up with for not being a Christian are just excuses. And for every excuse that you can come up with, God's got a better answer for that. So why not take Him up on that invitation? And understand the power of God to change everything about your life, to not just make you in His image and remake you in His image, but to give you purpose and to give you life and to give you work that you can't find anywhere else in this world, in this life. Why not take up His invitation to take your place in His work and to make a difference in the world around you, and not just in the world around you, but to make a difference in eternity? That's what God's offering you tonight. And if that's what you want, we're here to encourage you. Whatever your spiritual need is, please let us know how we can help you. Come to the front and let's stand and sing together.